Hello, everyone, and welcome to the JW Show. I'm your host, Joshua Washington, director of the Institute for Black Solidarity with Israel. And with me today is Jahan Burns. Jahan is a practicing attorney in Birmingham, Alabama. She is married to Bob Burns, and they have two children. While Jahan and family support various charities, they are passionately engaged with Christians United for Israel, the American Israeli Public Affairs Committee, and Operation Life Shield, an organization that builds the life shelters to protect Israeli citizens living in areas most vulnerable to rocket attacks. Jahan, thank you so much for being with us today.
Thank you for having me, Joshua.
Of course, of course. So, Jahan, for our listeners, why don't you let us know a little bit about yourself? Tell us where you're from and what was life growing up like for you?
Okay. Thanks, Josh. So I was born in Uganda. That's in East Africa. And my dad was in the military. And he trained in various countries. But one of his last countries to training was Israel. He trained there as a commando. And he then came back to Uganda. So in his day, when you were in the military in Uganda, you were a soldier for life. And so he served various governments in Uganda, including Idi Amin's government, when we had the whole situation that led to Operation Entebbe. So my dad stayed in the army until he was assassinated in 1986. When I was about 6 and a half. So my dad had an army and was sort of fighting for peace in Uganda during that time when he was assassinated. So following his death, life was very, very, very hard. We were in the middle of civil war. There was anarchy. There was the courts of law were just almost non-operative. And I remember after coming from the funeral, we got home and one of my dad's friends actually had taken our home, and there was nowhere to go. You couldn't report him to the police. You couldn't file a lawsuit. Everything was broken down. So one day we had a really nice home, and the next day we were destitute. And so my mom had to pick up the pieces, and it wasn't easy, but she was a very hardworking person, very determined, and managed to really help us go through very good schools. So I had very, very good education and ended up in a boarding school that was started by British missionaries. And it was there that I came to know Jesus. My mom was Muslim, so I was raised as a Muslim until I was a teenager, and I went to this missionary school and came to know Jesus. So after school, at some point, the president of Uganda took over our education and helped my mom a lot with our education. And then I got a scholarship to law school and went to law school. And after I graduated, I moved to England, and then I eventually migrated to the U.S. And so I live in Alabama.
Wow. And Jahan, I want to back up for just a moment too. You said your father had an army, and he was fighting for peace, and he was assassinated. What happened? Why was he assassinated?
Well, I think Uganda's history was very turbulent, and for long period of time, like in the 70s, the 60s, pretty much the late 60s, the 70s, we had civil war with government after government being toppled. And most people that are a bit older are familiar with a dictator that we had in Uganda called Idi Amin. And when he was in power, he killed a lot of Ugandans, hundreds and thousands of Ugandans. I believe that's the number is somewhere in there. And after he was overthrown, the situation in Uganda was very, very bad. And so you had all these fighting factions. you know, in the north Uganda, there were fighting factions in the south, in the west. My father's tribe predominantly lived, occupies the central part of Uganda, Kampala, you know, our capital city. Mm. And so my dad, you know, was fighting with his army in the central part, southern and central part mostly, and, you know, trying to keep peace there. Mm. And in 1985, all these factions, most of these factions decided to come together to form a unity government. And, you know, they figured that if they could form that unity government, they would try and achieve some sort of peace, right?
Right.
It was like power sharing sort of venture. But it didn't work out. The problem with Uganda, at least, is we have so many tribes. Now, while it's good for culture experience, the reality, as far as unity is concerned, it's had its challenges. It's presented mm-hmm. a lot of challenges because you have at least 50 tribes in Uganda, and wow. and many of them speak totally different languages, and cultures are different. And so unifying these different people groups was historically was a huge challenge.
Yeah.
And so interestingly, I remember watching a BBC documentary a few years back that was produced in 1985, you know, and it followed this unity government and the people there and what the peace process looked like. And I remember looking at, you know, this documentary and I looked at, there was a scene where, you know, I saw my father with these leaders seated at a round table, you know, involved in peace talks, and so many of those leaders were assassinated. So there was like a systematic eradication of people that were in leadership at the time. And wow. to this day, at least for my dad, we don't know who assassinated him. What I do remember is it was a day, like a weekday, and I had to go to school and there was fighting. There was a lot of fighting that day. And, you know, we had to use like a military convoy to be able to get through to school. And 2 hours after I was dropped off, my dad came back, picked me up, and there was so much fighting in Kampala, in the city. He dropped me off at home and he received a phone call actually when we got home, and it was someone from the unity government calling him for talks, peace talks at this famous hotel in Uganda. And that was the last we saw him. He got Range Rovers, about 4 Range Rovers, filled them with bodyguards. And what we are told, one of the bodyguards was a young boy that managed to escape. And they say he's the only person that survived that attack, wow. that they walked into an ambush and they beheaded the other bodyguards. And then they drove my dad to a lonely road and shot him multiple times. And they threw his body in a ditch. Wow. Fortunately, when they did that, one of his hands was left, you know, was left kind of not dangling, but it didn't fall into the ditch with the rest of his body. Mm. And so, but whoever did it tipped off the radio station, the media, and they began to send out search parties because how we heard about it was we had it on the news that wow. we've had reports that George Nkwanga is dead,
wow.
and we just didn't know where to start looking.
Mm-hmm.
And so we started look, you know, all these search parties, his friends, soldiers, they just started looking all over the city. And one of his friends was driving in one of the suburbs called Bugolobi on a road called Silver Springs.
Mm-hmm.
And he said for some reason, he just kept on driving up and down that road. And then he just happened to look at, to turn his head and look outside and to his left, and he saw a hand, and you, Josh, what's incredible about this is this was a time of war, so it could have been any corpse, right? Because people were murdered and just left there, but somehow it was God's plan to let us have closure, because his friend just saw that hand, and he didn't know whose hand it was, but he, something within him made him stop. And so he stopped the car and went and looked. And this is like maybe 1.5 to 2 weeks after, you know, the initial report came out that he was dead. Wow. So he, the way he identified him was, my dad always wore a bracelet and that had his army number and his name. And that's how he identified him initially anyway. And so I was about 6.5. And so imagine there, they bring you this corpse that is almost unrecognizable. They tell you this is your dad, you know, and the last picture you saw of your dad was this amazing, handsome, you know, full of life person. And now, you know, it was very, very difficult for me to process at that age. And I kind of went through the funeral in a blur. Mm. But, you know, we survived somehow. Yeah. It was hard, but, you know, I'm grateful for, where I'm at now.
Wow. And yeah. Jahan, I mean, that's some really heavy stuff. I mean, I just, in all this, one question I have for you is, so with all that's going, that was going on in Uganda, when, for you, when did you become a Zionist? Where does Israel fall into all this for you? What made you love Israel like yeah. you do now?
Yeah, it's a good question. So, Josh, I think I always had a curiosity about Israel because, mm-hmm. You know, my dad having trained there, he had great things to say about Israel and mm-hmm. and how humane they were compared, for example, to some of the other countries that he had trained in. Mm-hmm. And so I had that curiosity. And then when I went to this missionary school got involved in, you know, I started attending chapel and I became a Christian. Mm. And when I remember that when I became a Christian, I had a very deep hunger for the Bible. Mm. So actually what made me a Christian was I decided to read the Bible, and I started in Genesis, and I read, and I couldn't stop reading. Mm. I read the book of Genesis, and I read all the way until I couldn't see anymore. You know, it was dark. And I went back the next day, and then the third day. And so I read the whole Bible within 3 days.
Wow.
And I remember being so moved by what I read in the Bible. But one of the things that was so moving to me was this love relationship between God and Israel. Mm. I was an avid reader anyway. I used to read anything I could get my hands on, you know, and as a person that had sort of grown up practicing my mother's religion, Islam, I had tried to read the Quran, you know, a number of times, but nothing was as compelling to me as a Bible. Mm. And I never read anything like the story of the God of Israel. Mm. And this God who chose Abraham, made Abraham into a nation. And then he went and rescued this nation from Israel with these great powerful acts. And they just watched over it, you know, and just watched over these people. Mm-hmm. It was so compelling and amazing to me that I remember when I finished reading that Bible, I just thought, I want the God of Israel. You know, mm-hmm. I want to have a God that loves me, that fights for me, that defends me, like this God defended this nation and its people. Mm-hmm. So I remember I went into that chapel and I knelt down and I didn't really know how to give my life to God, right? Mm-hmm. I'd never seen a salvation track. No one had really ever explained to me how you give your life to Jesus or anything like that. But mm-hmm. I remember, so when I knelt down to pray, it was a very honest conversation. It was more like, God of Israel, you know, if I have all this trauma and all this darkness and this grief in my life, but if you will change me, if you will help me, if you will take away my sadness and my grief and my trauma, I will serve you for the rest of my life. Mm. And I remember that my heart just filled with this peace and joy, and I just began to cry. And I wasn't crying because I was sad. I was crying because, I don't know, I felt different. I felt happy. And And I remember when I stood up, I knew something had changed about me within me. And I began to really read the Bible. But my curiosity about Israel and my love for Israel was really, it intensified with my becoming a Christian. Mm-hmm. And so at that time, I began to read anything I could on Israel. Mm-hmm. And I was about 15, 16, you know, mid-90s. And there wasn't much, you know, when you're in a boarding school, you can't get your hands on too many, you know, too many resources. But every little that I could get my hands on, you know, newspapers, I began to read about modern day Israel. And most importantly, I began to pray for Israel, you know, as a teenager. And I made like a vow to myself. And I said, you know, if I ever get a chance, I will give to Israel. I will love Israel. I will visit Israel. And I didn't know how it would ever happen, you know. But it was a vow I made to myself. And even though I could not give to Israel at that time, you know, in a tangible way, I could pray for Israel. And so I did that throughout the years until I moved to England. And I remember the first thing, you know, first week of moving to England, I was in a London suburb in northern London. Mm. And I saw a synagogue, and I just jumped out, you know, I jumped out of the bus, you know, the next bus stop, and I went to meet these Jewish people. Because they were the first Jewish people I was encountering, and I was so enamored, excited, and so that's where the journey began. And it's God has not disappointed me, and Israel has not disappointed me. You know, there are times you have a longing and a desire for something or someone, and you get to it, and you're like, "Ish," you know, this isn't what I thought it would be. But for me, it's been incredible. And I think, Josh, what I found was so interesting to me is how I had this deep longing for Israel all these years. And the first time I went to Israel and I heard the story of Theodor Herzl, you know, I was so moved. Because one of the things I found out about Theodor Herzl, well, I remember the first thing was to see how this man had this dream of a nation, right? Mm-hmm. Of his people coming back to their land and establishing a nation at a time when not many people believed in the same dream that he had. Mm-hmm. But he worked for it. He worked towards it. He lived and breathed it. Yeah. You know, it so inspired me. And then I found out that during that time, Theodor Herzl had worked with the British government or parliament and came up with what they call the Uganda Plan, because at that time they did not, you know, it wasn't readily apparent to them that Jews could come back to the land of Palestine, as it was called at that time, because there were all these challenges. And so he worked with the British Parliament to say, maybe we could create a temporary place where Jews are welcome to go and until we can work everything out for them to return to the land of their ancestors. And so that's how the Ugandan plan came about, that they were going to have a place in Uganda. At that time, Uganda was a protectorate. Yeah. And so that was approved. But I believe that there was a conference for Jews in maybe Switzerland, and they voted against the Uganda plan. But I keep on thinking, how interesting is that we've always had that connection there, you know?
Wow.
So, yeah.
Wow. The Uganda plan. That's incredible.
Yes. You should read about it.
Absolutely.
It's incredible.
Absolutely. Yeah. I will. And Jahan, and you've spoken quite a bit about, as a Christian, what Israel means to you. And I want to know if there is also a connection for you to Israel, as a Ugandan, like as an African, do you see connections there, or is there a connection you feel there to Israel as well?
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely, Josh. Mm-hmm. I mean, aside, we always have the, as Christians, we always have that biblical divine mandate, you know, to love Israel, to support Israel, to bless Israel. Mm-hmm. And that first and foremost is always the driving force, you know, the inspiration to please the heart of God, because Israel mm-hmm. is important to the heart of God. And if you love someone, you love what they love, right? I love mm-hmm. God, and I love what He loves. So that is a main driving force for me. Mm-hmm. However, I think I mentioned a little bit earlier about Operation Entebbe. Mm,
yes.
That we had a former Ugandan president, dictator, that cooperated with Libya and they hijacked this plane, you know. The terrorists hijacked this plane and the plane flew to Libya and then it was welcomed in Uganda by Idi Amin and they took all these people hostage, and Benjamin Netanyahu's brother Yoni and led a team of Israeli commandos to Uganda to rescue those hostages, and unfortunately, you know, he died. Yoni died there. Mm. But you know, for me, that was, as a person that loves Israel, as a person that believes what the Bible says about blessing Israel, that was a huge tragedy. Mm. And for many Christians, for many Ugandan Christians, we that was something that, as we got more and more aware of the importance of Israel to the heart of God, that was always such a terrible tragedy, a very regrettable event. And for years, many Ugandan Christians prayed about that. They prayed for the love of God, for the forgiveness of God, wow. you know, to be on our land. Because, I mean, we've been, as a country, Uganda suffered so much. Mm. And I know that for many Ugandan Christians, there's been such a concerted effort to repent for that event. Mm. To, you know, I know many Christians that go to Israel, you know, to pray for Israel, to bless Israel, to say, look, we know that we have this horrible, tragic event that happened, you know, in our land, but we want you to know we love you, and we want to make up for the past by showing you our love, by giving you our prayers. And Uganda is a very pro-Israel, that because we have a very large Christian community. It's very, very pro-Israel. Mm. I see videos, even now while I'm in America, I get videos of Ugandans just having nights to honor Israel, you know, prayers to honor Israel. And so it means a lot. I remember 2 years ago, I went to Israel on a trip, and it was the Holocaust Remembrance Day. Mm. And lots of people, there were lots of people. And so we were going through security, and I noticed a lady, and she was wearing the traditional dress for my tribe, the Baganda. Mm. And it's a very distinct dress, very long. It's like a sari, but with sleeves that are huge, like elephant ears. I mean, like, you really can't miss it. And I'm just like, this is someone from my country, from my tribe.
Wow.
Like, what? And it was a cold day. And I'm just like, you know, it's so bulky. It's not the kind that you can, it's very hard to wear, like jackets all over it. Like, it
sounds, oh no, like,
she must be freezing. Yeah. Oh, yeah. And the material is usually silky, you know, and so I just kept on staring at her, but she was part of another group, and I was a part of another group, and we're, you know, separated by security. And so we didn't really have a chance to meet. So we were shown to our sitting area, and I ended up getting in this conversation with a rabbi that I know, they are like super nice man, and we're talking, and someone standing nearby overheard our conversation, and he said, "Hey, you have an accent. Where are you from?" I said, "Well, this accent is from, I'm from Uganda originally." He's like, "Oh my goodness, I work at Yad Vashem, you know, the Holocaust Museum, and we have a group." Yeah, it's like, "We have a group, and part of our group is a lady from your country." And I was like, "Oh, wow." You know, so my mind races to that lady. I'm like, that must be her. And so I'm like, "Would you please introduce me?" And Josh, let me tell you what, how God works in such amazing ways. So shortly after I came to Christ, you know, as a Christian, I was a young believer in a Muslim home with very, very limited to no freedom of worship. You know,
right.
And I remember that I was living with a relative at that time, you know, and it was a holiday season, and I went to live with one of my relatives, and I couldn't go to church. But there was a nearby church right next to her house, and I could hear the services, the sermons, the prayers when I sat on the veranda in, you know, at my aunt's house. And that is what encouraged me during that time, listening to this man speak and preach and pray. Even though I could not physically go, I could hear his voice. And I remember that that man died suddenly in an accident. And his wife, who had been living in a country, in abroad, in the West, came to his funeral. And I remember she preached with such fervor and passion. And I remember thinking, wow, this woman, she's her heart is breaking. She's just lost her husband. But the love that she has for God, I didn't hear her at any point blame God. She just encouraged the congregation and told them to stand firm and to trust God. And I always thought, you know, I never forgot her. And I thought, that's one person I would love to meet, because she showed such strength and fortitude at a time that most people fall apart. How about I'm now at Yad Vashem, and this is the very same woman that I was introduced to? Yeah, it was so incredible to me. And so I told her that story. I'm like, "Do you know, I have wanted to meet you for years, you know, and I never thought we would, because she lives in a different country. I live in a different country. And what are the odds that we would meet in Israel and that this woman would be a Zionist, a very strong Zionist, a very strong supporter for Yad Vashem?" So all this to tell you is that Ugandans are very pro-Israel. And that very same day, she's like, "Oh, you won't believe it. She's like, it's not just me. There is, you know," she's like, "there's another gentleman in our group." And she introduces me to this gentleman. And he turns out to be the editor. He used to be the editor of our main newspaper in Uganda. And I remember the first year that I moved to the U.S., I decided to open up about my father's death and how it affected our family. And I remember writing an article about it. And I decided to send it in. And this was an editor that published it and polished it, and it touched so many people. But I had never met him. And so here I was now at Yad Vashem, and I told him who I was, and both our minds went back to that article and how it had affected the whole country. And we just hugged and cried, and I found out he'd written a book about Israel. He's very prayerful. So it was very heartwarming, very encouraging that I'm not the only person from Uganda that has a love and a passion for Israel.
Wow.
Yeah.
I want to pause right here, you all. The JW Show will be right back. Don't go anywhere.
Time for Get Deep, Old Jerusalem.
How can we sing the Lord's song in a strange land? How can we sing the Lord's song with shackles on our hands? But Zion calls to us, the city of our God.
Lift up your heads, O ye gates,
ye everlasting doors.
Oh, Jerusalem,
come on to you.
Jerusalem,
whoa, 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 whoa.
If I forget thee, O Jerusalem.
Say it again, say it.
Jerusalem,
come on.
Welcome back to the JW Show. I'm here with Jahan Burns once again, and we're going to continue our conversation. It's just, it's incredible just to hear some of these stories. I mean, like you said it yourself, that Ugandans are very pro-Israel, even though the government hasn't reflected that, you know, in history. And you were talking about Operation Entebbe for a little bit, and that happened about 10 years before your father was assassinated, you said in 86, right?
Correct, yes.
And so what do you feel that, and you mentioned, you talked about it a little bit, and maybe I'm hoping you can maybe talk about it some more. I know that there are some who say that the fact that Uganda was the place where the terrorists took the hijacked plane, and also where Prime Minister Netanyahu's brother was killed, that actually, you know, when we talk about the scripture in Genesis 12:3 that says, "I will bless those who bless you, curse those who curse you," there are some Ugandans who say that actually brought God's curse on the country. That is an Israeli was killed on Uganda's soil, and that Uganda also was a haven for those terrorists. Can you speak a little more? What are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, so Josh, I think as Christians, when we look at, for example, if we even just start in the Bible, how that there is a curse that God pronounces on the enemies of Israel, that if you persecute Israel, God himself is going to fight against you. Mm. We see that all through the Bible.
Right.
And we see it in history. You know, we see in history that God has always fought for his people, and that the persecutors of Israel, you know, and the Jewish people throughout history have disappeared from the face of the earth, while the Jewish people have survived against all odds. Mm. Who do you think is looking out for them? God is.
Absolutely.
And so what happened in Uganda? Of course, as a Christian, I look at that as an action, you know, that to act against innocent people, especially, you know, people that God has a covenant with that is promised to protect. Yeah, it is going to invite a curse, you know, and that is something that you need to repent of. Anti-Semitism, that invites a curse. That is something that if you are a person that has been involved in it, you need to repent of it, because it displeases God, and God has said he will not bless that kind of conduct, and he will punish that kind of conduct. So you know, those are not my words. Those are God's words, right. And I'm not going to argue with him. You know, and I think that many Ugandans that are enlightened to those biblical passages have been very, very, very proactive about praying, about repenting, you know, for that, and asking God for blessings. There is a pastor in Uganda I like and respect. He's called Mulinde, John Mulinde, and he leads every year. He leads groups of people to Israel, and they pray. You know, they pray for the welfare of Israel. They pray for the blessings of Israel. You know, I believe that as a people, you know, that is something that we, for most of the people, I can't say I'm speaking for everyone, but what I'm aware of for most Ugandan people, especially Christians, is they're very now, they're welcoming now of Israel, and they're appreciative of the renewed friendship. I can't, you know, when Benjamin Netanyahu came to Uganda a few years ago, you cannot believe in the Christian community, because those are people that I was corresponding with at that time about that issue, how emotional we were. We cried.
Yeah.
We, you know, I was already an American citizen, but I cried, because, I mean, you think about it.
Yeah.
If your brother or your sibling got killed in the kind of circumstances that his brother was killed in, you know, by this nation, you know, And this man had the forgiveness to come to that nation,
right,
and bring that forgiveness. To me as a Ugandan, that meant so much.
Wow.
That meant I forgive you. Mm. That meant I'm willing to work with you. That meant I'm extending the olive branch. And I think for many of us, we took it like that, at least in the, I can say for the Christian community, yes, that was, it was like God was just telling us, it's okay. It felt like getting a big hug from God, you know, after the prayers and just the, you know, the passion with which we threw ourselves in, you know, to pray for God's hand and for His favor upon our country.
And he and Prime Minister Netanyahu, he was the first Prime Minister of Israel to visit Uganda since the Operation Entebbe. Is that right? So 40 years.
I believe so.
40 years. I believe
so. Wow. Yeah. And I'll tell you that there's so many Israelis doing amazing things in Uganda. One of the organizations that I love is Innovation Africa. And Innovation Africa has a female CEO.
Yes, ma'am.
Sivan Yari.
Yes, Sivan. Yeah.
She's incredible, incredible. She's taken, you know, solar power to villages in Uganda, water. I remember watching a presentation about it while I was in Israel. I remember talking to her. She has such a big heart. I mean, it's awesome, you know. And I remember a few years ago, we were in a meeting, and with one of the Prime Minister, Benjamin Netanyahu's spokesperson, and I asked that question. I said, "Well, is Israel interested in Africa and engaging Africa?" And he was, I mean, his face just lit up. He was like, "Oh my goodness, yes, yes." He's like, the Prime Minister, that is one of his huge big priorities is to engage Africa. There is so much that Africa can benefit from Israel, and there's a lot of cooperation that can happen between African countries and Israel. You know, think about it. Israel is a huge technological power, and Africa is not, and we need that technology. And but also Africa has a lot of resources, and we need ethical people because we've worked with some unethical countries that have really exploited our resources and our people. So I would rather that we work with a nation as ethical as Israel that can work with us to further, you know, our development in Africa.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. Absolutely. And at no negative or unnecessary expense to you.
Correct.
To the African continent. Absolutely. Jahan, so, and you touched on it a little bit too. You know, we see now, especially recently, that Israel's starting to normalize ties with different African countries. Do you see any hope for relations between Israel and Uganda? And how so, if so?
I believe so. I think that Uganda is pro-Israel. You know, I think what happened in 1976, that's not where we are now as a country. I think that we see that Uganda sees Israel as a friend, as an ally, as a country that has a lot to offer. You know, that's how I see it, and that's my opinion, of course. But it's not baseless. I'm just looking at how things are going. Did you know, Josh, that in Uganda, in the eastern part of Uganda, there is a community that many, many years ago in towards the early 1900s, this, you know, the man that started this community converted to Judaism. He was a man called Semei Kakongulu, converted to Judaism. And he became like a leader of this community of Jewish people. You know, they're like Ugandan Jews. Did you know that we have Ugandan Jews in Uganda?
Right, right. Wow.
For years and years and years, and they've practiced Judaism until this day.
Right.
So even the fact that we have in Uganda a community that is growing and actually strong now, vibrant community that is Jewish, and that is developing very strong connections to Jews all over the world, especially Israel, shows you that the breakdown that happened between Uganda and Israel in 1976 is not there now. That I think the country is moving, every year the country moves to in a more positive direction as far as having good ties with Israel is concerned.
Absolutely. Jahan, if I need to ask you this question, because we started off talking about your father, and you mentioned briefly that he too loved Israel. Is that right? Did I get that right?
Correct.
And so if he were here now, what do you, in seeing what you're doing now, the work that you're doing, and all the things that you do, and I didn't even ask you about your work in Birmingham right now. I mean, you sit on different boards, the Birmingham Jewish Federation and the Birmingham Holocaust Education Center. The work that you do and how you advocate for Israel the way that you do, what do you think he would say today?
I think he would be very proud. He would be very, very proud. Do you know, so I served on the Birmingham Jewish Federation board for quite a number of years, and I stepped off this year, earlier this year, and then I stepped onto the Birmingham Holocaust Education Center board. My dad would be proud because he was a person that cared about suffering, about righting wrongs, about justice. And I care about those things too, especially, you know, Holocaust education. One of the things I remember listening to a Holocaust survivor, I went to speak at a Jewish Federation. And after I spoke, one of the a Holocaust survivor approached me and just gave me a big long hug, and she said, you know, I'm glad that we have that history of suffering together, because it helps us have hope. It helps us have we're able to look at life and look at it with eyes of hope, eyes of strength, and to inspire others to be better and to do better. And I remember, you know, her story was very compelling. I mean, if I went into it, we'd be here for another hour. It was so compelling, and I just kept on thinking about it and thinking about it. So it drove me to read more and more stories of survivors. And then visiting, like every year when I go to Israel, I have to go to Yad Vashem. You know, last year I took a bunch of people that were friends of mine and introduced them to a really prominent survivor that works at Yad Vashem, that told them her story, and these people had not really had Holocaust education. Wow. And it was so, you could see how amazed and touched that they were, that they were very, very touched. And so I find that, you know, the more we educate people about the suffering, the trauma, the Holocaust, the more people are aware of what anti-Semitism is. And when you do that, you equip them with the resources and the will to fight it, and the will to say no, never again, you know. And that is a form of fighting for justice, you know, because we have people that are Holocaust deniers. And I think when someone denies your pain, you know, it's almost like it's very disrespectful, very belittling. It's very threatening, because if someone denies the things that you've been through, it means that it sends a message that they're not willing to stand up for you if something like that ever happens, were to happen again, you know?
Yeah.
And so my passion, I want to put my energy into educating people, into, you know, making people aware that we have a choice and we can use our choice for good, for justice. So I think he would be very proud because those are the ideals he lived by.
Absolutely. Jahan, first of all, I just want to thank you so much for sharing with us today. I mean, this has been invaluable, and I know that our listeners are really going to appreciate this segment. I just have one more question for you before we go, if that's okay.
Okay.
One thing that's been ringing for me ever since Prime Minister Netanyahu said it was that he said Israel's returning to Africa and Africa is returning to Israel.
Mm-hmm.
How do you see that happening with Uganda? How is Uganda returning to Israel and how is Israel returning to Uganda?
Oh, wow. So I think in some of the things we've discussed today, Josh, that Israel is returning to Uganda. Look at Prime Minister's visit there.
Mm.
But look at what Israelis are doing. I wrote, I remember a few months ago, I was reading this story about Israeli water engineers. These were young people. These were young Israelis that engineers that had graduated and were starting out life, and they went to Africa, and they took, you know, they took all their resources, their tools, and they were just providing water. Now you think about it, most young people, it's not that they're callous or anything like that, but they have a lot of other things to do, especially when someone is just starting out, right? Some of them may be starting families or careers, and you know, they have so much, you know, to engage them in their home and in, you know, in their own local sphere of influence. But these were young engineers that took time off. They're giving life, you know, they're giving your life back. So that, you know, Israel is giving to Africa. There's no doubt about that. Africa is returning to Israel, and it's what I kind of touched on earlier, that Africa has a lot of resources. You know, I look at Uganda. We're a very small country. We have all kinds of minerals, and now, you know, they've discovered oil, and that needs to be explored. And you know, I love Israel because I have, you know, I've witnessed Israelis firsthand. I've witnessed how humane they are, even to their enemies. And, you know, what better person to partner with? What better country to partner with in your developmental goals? You know, so for me, that my desire is to see African countries engage Israel more, you know, more and more, you know, in areas that we need them, and we need them in lots and lots of areas. I believe I've read or I've heard that Uganda's military, Uganda has one of the best military forces in Africa. You know, and one of the better equipped countries militarily, and I believe it's been a big partner with the U.S. In fighting terrorism in Africa. But I believe I heard or I read from a credible source told me that Uganda gets its most of its military equipment from Israel and training, you know, because when they buy, then Israelis also train them on how to use this, and so even in the fight against terrorism, and you know, that's been an area where Uganda has benefited, you know. So I feel like if African leaders would have the willingness and the foresight to engage Israel more, that we would even see bigger development than we see now. Wow. And I'm hoping that they go that way, you know. Absolutely. I'm hoping that African leaders will also be able to speak up for Israel in the United Nations, you know.
Absolutely. Jahan, I really appreciate you for taking time and speaking with me today. Thank you so much.
Oh, you're welcome, Jahan.
Yeah, really appreciate it. I'm
grateful
insight.
For the opportunity.
Absolutely. I hope maybe we can do it again soon. I know you have a lot to share and a lot of stories, and I know our listeners would love to hear it. But thank you.
Oh, you're welcome. Yeah. Thank you.
And thank you all for listening. Once again, this is the JW Show. I'm Joshua Washington, Director of the Institute for Black Solidarity with Israel, and I'm signing off.